compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I don't know if you heard the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau commenting. Man, I mean, he's putting all his cards on the table. He's a hard leftist. Listen to what he said. Well, I won't even try to describe it. Here's what he said.
What we learned from this climate, this COVID crisis, we will be applying to the climate crisis, to the housing crisis, to reconciliation, to making sure that everyone has good jobs and careers that carry them through and create opportunities for their kids.
What? Okay, let me break this down. What we learned, because, you know, part of the, formerly part of the British Empire, what we learned from this COVID crisis, we will be applying to the climate crisis, to the housing crisis, to reconciliation, to making sure everyone has good jobs. What, Cyrus, what have we learned from the COVID crisis that is applicable to any of those things? I'll give you the first guess.
No comment.
All right.
No comment.
Scaredy cat?
Yo, you better believe it.
Well, I'll fill in the blank. What we learned from this COVID crisis, we will be applying to, and then fill in the blanks, is how to control people. How to strong arm and control and instill fear and foment division and create a crisis and get people to jump when we snap the whip. I think that's what he's talking about. I mean, what else? I mean, how does virology, epidemiology apply to housing? Mm-hmm. It doesn't. How does virology and epidemiology, how does that apply in any way to the climate crisis? It doesn't. So I think what he's, let's hear it again, because I think that's what he's saying. What he's saying is, hey, boy, have we learned a few tricks. We now know what needs to be done to get what we want. And guess what? We've got all kinds of other issues we're going to apply these things to now. Let's hear it one more time.
It works. Let's use this ointment on everything.
Yeah.
What we learned from this climate, this COVID crisis, we will be applying to the climate crisis, to the housing crisis, to reconciliation, to making sure that everyone has good jobs and careers that carry them through and create opportunities for their kids.
It's gobbledygook, but it does mean something. And I think the embedded little point that he's making is, like we just said, we now have new tools at our disposal and we will apply them vigorously.
Fear will keep the local systems in line.
Where have I heard that before?
That is one of my many Star Wars buttons.
Yeah. And you have a whole Star Wars screen of just Star Wars things.
I should. But I think you would poo-poo that.
I would.
I got to sprinkle them in, you know, when I can.
I find your lack of diversity disturbing.
That's good.
Your lack of faith disturbing.
You just had it right there. You have them all right there.
I won't do that anymore.
Can we hear Justin Trudeau one more time telling us what to expect? Well, he's telling Canadians, but I think this is probably
Darth Vader, but sure.
One more time.
What we learned from this climate, this COVID crisis, we will be applying to the climate crisis, to the housing crisis, to reconciliation, to making sure that everyone has good jobs and careers that carry them through and create opportunities for their kids.
Does he mean that you'll only be able to get a house if you're wearing a mask? Does he mean that you'll only be able to have good weather if you're wearing a mask? Is that what he means?
Yeah, you said earlier you don't know whether to laugh or to cry, and yeah. I always think of a great Vonnegut line. I choose to laugh. It's less messy.
Yeah, you're right. I do a lot of laughing these days, but it's not always out of humor because some of the stuff is just so ridiculous that I don't know what else to do. But, you know, we keep pressing forward and onward and upward, right? 888-914-9149. How about Andrea in Tampa? Good morning, Andrea.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
I wanted to touch, I've been on hold for a bit, so I wanted to comment on something that you mentioned a few moments ago about the gentleman, the, I guess, anti-masker who sadly died of COVID.
Yeah.
You mentioned that he was taking ivermectin as a treatment. And the reason for my call was that we just buried my cousin, who was like a sister to me, a few weeks ago, not because of COVID, but her fear of COVID. And she was taking ivermectin prophylactically. Mm. And it landed her in the hospital, and ultimately she died from it.
Terrible. How old was
and
she?
And so even 56.
Okay. Wow.
And, you know, the last time I saw her was in May at my daughter's first communion, and she wouldn't leave her house for anything, but she did come to that. So she would go to church, but otherwise she wasn't leaving her house because she was very afraid of COVID. And she also, you know, did not want to get vaccinated. But anyways, I just wanted to, you know, there's a lot of people out there, you know, very kind of, and I hate to say this term, I don't want to say flippantly saying that, you know, ivermectin is a treatment. But, you know, today on my local news here in Tampa, Florida, they reported that just here in this county, they've had 27 calls to poison control because of people taking ivermectin.
Yeah.
And so it's a very dangerous drug that people need to be careful of. And, you know, I'm not really sure where people are reading about it or hearing about it or how they're getting a hold of it, but it is potentially very dangerous. And in this case, unfortunately, it was fatal. She was giving it to her 20-something-year-old son as well, and he did not experience the full effects that she did, but he is having some issues. It's caused his throat to swell a bit. He's got one eye that's a little bit droopy.
I'm sorry to hear this. Well, I can only imagine that it must be, first of all, it's such a shock to your family that an otherwise healthy woman that young would die from this. I don't know what else to say except that medical doctors are there for a reason and their advice is sound. I mean, we should listen to them and they have the training. I mean, as I understand it, and I've talked to other people who have discussed ivermectin, and as I understand it, it's an anti-parasite drug that you give to horses and other animals. And it's at the tractor supply store, or it's at, you know, the Rural King store. And there are people who are going in and buying this ostensibly for animals, but they're taking it themselves. And as you say, that is not smart. And situations like this will arise in some cases. So you have my condolences, Andrea. I'm so sorry to hear about your sister.
Thank you. Thank you. My cousin, but she, like I said, she was like a sister to me. Very, very close. So anyway, but
may she rest in peace indeed. Well, thank you, Andrea. I appreciate that. Very sad. 888-914-9149. On to other matters. I want to share this with you. The CDC, just a minute ago, I was talking about the medical doctors and we should listen to them. Well, here are some medical doctors, but they're not talking about medicine. They have issued an inclusive language guide. I would think the CDC would have more than enough to do with medical issues that they don't have the time to waste on something like issuing a language guide. Let me read it to you. This is from the Daily Wire. Referring to people as elderly, uninsured, or an inmate is apparently dehumanizing and not inclusive, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. In what appears to be a recently published guide, the CDC lists numerous descriptors and phrases that it claims aren't inclusive before providing a list of non-stigmatizing language. The guide includes multiple sections, grouping terms under banners such as disability and homelessness before saying those words they're not inclusive enough. Now, if you read the article, you'll see the links to this guide so that you can check it out for yourself. They give some examples. Under the disability heading, the guide says that words like disabled, differently abled, and handicapped are stigmatizing and should be replaced with lengthier phrases like people with disabilities or people with a disability or people who use a wheelchair or mobility device. And by the way, I thought that differently abled, as I remember when that became a thing, back in, I guess, when did I first start hearing that? Maybe in the 80s? That was considered the preferred alternative to disabled. So if you said that somebody was differently abled, you weren't pointing out that they had a disability. At least that was the rationale that I heard. The CDC is aware that some individuals with disabilities prefer to use identity-first terminology, which means a disability or disability status is referred to first. For the purposes of these guidelines, the CDC says they're promoting person-first language. Most of the guide is similar, suggesting the shorter identifier is wrong, but simply adding people with ahead of that apparently makes it more inclusive. The guide's headlines are in alphabetical order, so the first section is titled Corrections and Detentions and suggests that words like inmate or prisoner or convict or ex-convict or offender or criminal or parolee and detainee are all stigmatizing words. Now, before I go on to what the words the CDC suggests that you use are instead of those words, there's a very good reason for the stigma associated with being an offender or a criminal or an inmate or a prisoner or a convict or an ex-convict. The reason there's a stigma attached to it is because they did something bad. There should be a stigma attached to it. And that's the way the real world works. If you do some things that are bad, you have now a stigma because you have been associated now with something that people judge to be bad. And that's what happens in this case. So there's no reason why they shouldn't, these words I'm talking about, that they shouldn't contain a stigma. So instead of these terms, inmate, prisoner, convict, ex-convict, etc., this is what the CDC is busy telling you. You should say, instead of those terms, you should say people who are incarcerated, persons who are detained, a partner or child of an incarcerated person, persons in pretrial or with charge. Cyrus, what does that even mean? If somebody said to you, Cyrus, do you know any persons in pretrial or with charge? What would you say? If you had read the CDC guideline,
you would know. I guess I'm not a very good citizen because I don't have that memorized yet.
They're talking here about a prisoner who hasn't been convicted yet or acquitted, but you're charged with a crime. So persons in pretrial or with charge, people who are formerly incarcerated, you can't say ex-con now. Oh, you're one of the people who were formerly incarcerated. Persons on parole or probation, non-U.S. citizens or immigrants in immigration detention facilities, and people in immigration detention facilities. I don't know what that's supposed to replace. The guideline also includes a section under drug and substance use. So the CDC suggests that you not call people alcoholics or smokers or drug users. Instead, you should say persons with substance use disorders. Or people who smoke. You can't call somebody a smoker.
Why are we afraid of using words that are direct and truthful?
Because somebody might get offended.
So simple and honest and direct language is dead.
It's dying. We have to keep it alive. So you better not say alcoholic or smoker or drug user. As far as elderly people are concerned, the CDC recommends calling people older adults or elders. Elders is kind of cool. You know, when I did a
council of the elders.
Yeah, that sounds sinister.
Oh, it's not supposed
to. I did a speaking event. It was a weekend speaking event in Malaysia some years ago. And so, you know, it's one island over from Singapore, where I was anyway. And I was really charmed by this. I really liked it. And that is that all the people, especially young people, anyone who was like not considerably older, but let's say at least 10 years older, they would call the men uncle and they would call the women aunt. And these are just people who have no relation to each other. There's no biological relation, just in their polite society. So they would call me uncle. And I saw them calling, you know, other men. And I remember when I first got there and I was seeing this, I asked the guy who was with me because he was driving me around. He was probably about my age. And I said, you have a really big family. And he says, what do you mean? He says, you're like the uncle to all these people. And he laughed. He said, no, that's just how we do it. So I kind of like that. I thought that was pretty cool. Instead of saying underserved people, the guide suggests people who are underserved, people who are uninsured. So you can't say an uninsured motorist now, according to the CDC. You have to say a person who is uninsured. Let's see. It even gets into race. The guy, and I'm quoting here from the article, under the race section, the guide includes predictable substitutions for gender and race-related terms, though even there, the guide is odd. It includes words like Afro-American and Negro, even though those aren't commonly used. It also suggests not referring to members of a particular race or ethnicity as a community, such as the black community. The CDC recommends adding persons after any racial or ethnic identifier, Asian persons, etc. Under the sexual orientation and gender identity section, the CDC suggests homosexual is wrong, but queer is acceptable. Man, oh man, let me tell you, when I was in high school, you know, if you called somebody a queer and that person was, you know, bigger and stronger than you, you might get punched out. But apparently that is now in vogue and it is acceptable. But if you call someone a homosexual, which is the clinical term for that proclivity, that's no longer acceptable. The supposedly science-based federal agency also says that biologically male and biologically female and genetically male and genetically female are now terms you're not supposed to use. Now, according to the CDC, you must say assigned male or assigned female at birth, or designated male at birth or designated female at birth. Gendered language is also out at the CDC, but you can call people two-spirit. Also, gendered pronouns appear in both the bad list and the good list. So they say good luck figuring that one out. The CDC suggests using terms that are inclusive of all gender identities. So instead of saying mom or dad-to-be, say simply parents-to-be. This seems to follow the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, using the term pregnant people instead of pregnant women. Perhaps one of the oddest words to be deemed non-inclusive by the CDC is stakeholder, which the agency defines as persons or groups who have an interest or concern in a project, activity, or course of action. The CDC suggests replacing stakeholder as much as possible and replacing it with words like informers, advisors, consultants, collaborators, and co-owners. What on earth is wrong with stakeholder? Aside from the, you know, eating animals connotation, which it doesn't have, but, I mean, do you see any problem with stakeholder, Cyrus?
We go to this well a lot, but this is so 1984 of the taking words and changing what they mean, mm-hmm. and replacing them with longer words to make everything more confusing.
See, you're not my producer anymore. You are the person who produces my show. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to ask the person who produces my show. I can't say producer, I guess. I don't know if the CDC reached down into the world of radio, but eventually when they run out of things to meddle with, maybe they'll do that too.
Let's make everything as confusing as possible.
Well, they're doing it. They're succeeding. Let's take a break and we'll do some phone calls. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. I'll be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compellingly inclusive and fully woke. Diverse and unpredictable conversations. Equality for your day. Your non-triggering, non-toxic ally. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Ha ha. That's a good one. You haven't played that one in a while, Cyrus.
It fits pretty well with what we were just talking about.
I think I am triggering, at least from some of the emails I get. Some people do get triggered. What can I tell you? Hey, Miss Ellie on Twitter, you get a gold star for this one. She says, let me get this straight. Stigma for criminals, bad. Stigma for non-maskers and non-vaxxers, good. Analysis, tyrannical clown world. I think you've got it just about right, Miss Ellie. What do you think, Cyrus? Stigma for criminals, bad, according to the CDC. stigma for non-maskers or non-vaxxers good. You know, there's a time and a place to stigmatize people. That's part of this too. But you have to be careful how you do it and to whom you do it, right? Well done, Miss Ellie. Well done. Let's go to the phones. Patty in Minneapolis. Nice to have you on the program. Welcome.
Good morning. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to respond to that woman who said her cousin died from ivermectin. And I'm sorry to hear that, you know, that story. Yeah. But there's misinformation on that side, too. Unfortunately, on both sides, as far as ivermectin, I think, you know, it's actually very, very effective. I'm in the medical profession. And if, you know, there's tons of research. It's been used, you know, for years. It's actually been used in humans to begin with and found, you know, this anyway, won't go through that history. But, you know, there's really, I think the thing is, it's like anything, if people are just taking willy-nilly without doctors, you know, advice and direction on how to use it, people can die from overdose of aspirin.
And that's what that's a good point. That's what I understood her to say. I'd have to go back and re-listen to it. But I think her point was that her cousin was just sort of self-medicating using this. And I think I extrapolated from that from people I have talked to who buy it at the tractor store. You know, it's intended for animals. So the scenario that she described, as I understood it, was not under the supervision of a doctor. It was just like, I'm going to grab the stuff.
Yeah, no, and it actually has been used for parasites and river blindness and all sorts of viral things now, Zika virus. And it won the Nobel Peace Prize for being a really safe, effective drug. And, you know, 4 billion doses have been given worldwide with very, very minimal, you know, side effects at all.
I would assume,
and I know,
Patty,
from colleagues who are prescribing it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I would assume that what you're just talking about there, that it is the form that is developed for human use, not the kind for horses that you'd buy at the, at the hardware store.
Correct. Dosing is based on weight, so it's, you know, we're not horses.
No, I get that. What I'm saying, though, is that I presume that there is a version of that that might be more suited for human beings versus the one that's intended for animals. Or are you saying that it's the same exact thing, but just a matter of dosage?
Well, no. I mean, horses are, they're getting a paste, and humans are getting a formulated tablet through Merck Pharmaceuticals. So it's, you know, it's a human form. It was actually created for humans to begin with.
That's what I mean.
And they, so I think, you know, FLCCC is a great website if people want to learn more about it. There's tons of research, and it's, you know, being used worldwide. In countries that will allow people to use it, actually. But
you know, I've heard the same is true, Patty, with hydroxychloroquine from a lady that I know very well. She's from Nigeria. And she says that it's just not passe, it's old hat. She said because in those tropical regions, people routinely take hydroxychloroquine to ward off malaria.
And the same with ivermectin for worms when they have water issues.
Yeah. So her point was that, at least as she explained it to me, was that they're not being hit hard by COVID the way other places are because they already are eating the hydroxychloroquine as prescribed for, let's say, you know, to avoid malaria. But
Right. No, and that's huge. And if you look at numbers and the cases around the world and people have actually studied the research with outbreaks, it's like amazing.
Yeah.
So hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, these drugs are effective. They're most effective if they're giving early before it's like Tamiflu. If you give it immediately when people have influenza, it's effective. If you wait 5 days, it's too late. I mean,
I see. I'm sorry, what was that?
It's going to work as well.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of clarify that from, you know, I think there's misinformation, unfortunately, and good things are not being used or people aren't being treated if they don't hear about, you know, they're just hearing one side of really bad reports.
Well, there's a concerted effort in the mainstream media. I've seen it, and I've been seeing it for quite a while, that is telling people don't take ivermectin, don't take hydroxychloroquine, and you know they look down upon people who do that. But as you say, I've been aware. I'm not in the medical field, but I've been aware that these are drugs that are used for various purposes among human beings. It's not as though they're suddenly now raiding the veterinarian's office and just getting stuff for animals and using it for themselves. This has already been tested and approved for human use for other things. The question is, because COVID is so political and because this came up in the previous administration, that now it seems that anybody who might want to use one of those medicines is looked down upon as, well, you're just a supporter of the previous administration. You're just a Trump supporter kind of thing. So, as you say, misinformation, but it's not just medical misinformation, it seems to me. Thanks, Patty. Appreciate the phone call. How about Joe now in Westchester, Pennsylvania? Hello, Joe. What do you know?
Good morning, Patrick. Good morning, Patrick. How are you, sir?
I am well. Thank you. Welcome.
I'm very glad to hear that. I'm so happy to have radio every morning.
Thank you.
I've got a quick question. I don't know how quick it is, actually. It's I just started reading The Diary of St. Faustina, and I was wondering about what your thoughts are with that, vis-a-vis the fact that, as I understand it, you know, all revelation has been included in the Bible, shall we say. I think that's our church's position.
Right. Right.
And given the fact that, you know, St. Faustina was spoken to apparently by Jesus and by the Blessed Mother, what's your thoughts on that? I mean, I'm searching for truth here. It's really what I come here for.
Well, that is private revelation, so we have to take that as such. It's not general revelation. So the Holy Bible, for example, is general revelation, and that is binding, but private revelation is not. It would only be binding upon the person who received it, but not on anyone else. So whether it's the Divine Mercy revelations or Fatima or what have you, I personally think that with regard to these approved apparitions, that you would be wise to pay attention to them and wise to put into practice the things that are said there, such as pray the rosary. Our Lady says that so frequently. But you're not obligated to. So I think it's the wise thing to do, and that's certainly what I do. Now, I distinguish that from unapproved so-called or alleged apparitions. There are many people out there who claim to be getting locutions and visions and revelations and things. I just pay them no, never mind. I just ignore that. And until and unless the church approves it, I don't give it any credence. Now, some of those things might be interesting, but I don't give them any credence as real unless and until the church approves them. But in the case of the Divine Mercy phenomenon, that was indeed approved. It was approved at the highest level by Pope John Paul II. And of course, we have the Divine Mercy Sunday added to the church's calendar of feasts. So I think you can read it and believe it and accept it on very good authority as the church proposes. So with regard to that, I don't think you can go wrong at all. Seeing it as
authoritative. Thank you very much. I forgot about that. I had forgotten about that. We're not obligated to believe private revelations, however. Probably a good idea. Thank you.
You're welcome, Joe. Hey, thank you. It sounds like you're driving, so stay safe, and thanks for listening to Relevant Radio while you're getting where you're going. I'd like to share with you, since we just talked a little bit about the Divine Mercy revelations, The diary is fascinating reading. I read it myself. It's not a short book. It's quite lengthy, but it's well worth reading, and I found it to be a page-turner. So I posted on my blog some years ago. This is actually 12 years ago that I posted this. I said, I've been reading the entire diary of St. Faustina these last couple of weeks and discovered to my surprise how very apocalyptic the messages are. The Lord repeatedly told her, and when I wrote this, it was over 70 years ago. So I said over 70 years ago that the Divine Mercy revelation was specifically given to prepare mankind for the second coming and the end of the world. It's a theme that reappears frequently. Here are a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. So these are verbatim quotes from the diary from St. Faustina. This is entry number 429. Write down these words, my daughter. Speak to the world about my mercy. Let all mankind recognize my unfathomable mercy. It is a sign for the end times. After it will come the day of justice. While there is still time, let them have recourse to the fount of my mercy. And diary entry number 635 says, you have to speak to the world about his great mercy. This is Our Lady speaking. You have to speak to the world about his great mercy and prepare the world for the second coming of him who will come, not as a merciful savior, but as a just judge. Oh, how terrible is that day! Determined is the day of justice, the day of divine wrath. The angels tremble before it. Speak to souls about this great mercy while it is still the time for granting mercy. Man, that caught my attention. This is entry number 965. Tell souls about this great mercy of mine, because the awful day, the day of my justice, is near. Now, I wrote this entry in my blog, and I'll get a link to this for you so you can read it for yourself. I wrote this in June of 2009. So we are now, 12 years down the road. And when these words were spoken to her, this was, you know, in the 1930s, I guess. And if the Lord is saying to her, the awful day of my justice is near, we're not quite 100 years beyond that point where he said this to her. So if it was near then, it makes me wonder, how near is it now? Probably really near. Here's the last one I'll give you. This is diary entry number 83. Write this: before I come as the just judge, I am coming first as the King of mercy. Before the day of justice arrives, there will be given to the people a sign in the heavens of this sort. All light in the heavens will be extinguished, and there will be great darkness over the whole earth. Then the sign of the cross will be seen in the sky, and from the openings where the hands and the feet of the Savior were nailed will come forth great lights, which will light up the earth for a period of time. This will take place shortly before the last day. Now, we haven't seen that yet, obviously. That would certainly make the evening news. But these are things that are approved. These are messages that are approved by the church, again, at the highest level. So don't you think it'd be a really good idea to pay attention to this, especially when the message is really all about repent of your sins, love God, turn away from the bad things in your life, love God, pray the rosary, love God, be a good husband, good wife, good son, good daughter, love God, and invoke God's mercy upon you and other people? I mean, doesn't that seem like it would be a really wise thing to do? I certainly think so. So I'm going to post this. We're going to take a break, and I will post this on my Twitter feed. And this is just where you can see these several selections, and then it gives a link to the place where you can read more about it. Actually, I think that link might be dead. But anyway, I'll get this posted for you, and then if you want to get the diary for yourself, it's easy to get. But take a look at it and put it into practice. Put it into use. I don't know what else I can say. Ask God for his mercy. I could sure use a lot of mercy. How about you, Cyrus? Could you use some mercy?
You know it, brother.
I can use a lot of mercy. All right, we'll be right back. It's all right.
Relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
This is good stuff. And you're probably thinking this is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Well, kind of, but not really. This is Tom Petty and a couple of the guys in the Heartbreakers, like Ben Montench on the keyboards and the guitarist. But this band is Mudcrutch, which was Tom Petty's earlier band that he was in for years before he formed Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So that's why it sounds familiar. I like this song a lot.
This screams Heartbreakers.
Yeah, it does.
That's good stuff.
And, you know, it's Tom Petty playing bass. He didn't play the lead guitar or rhythm guitar with Mudcrutch. I guess he played bass. Kind of cool.
That is what a cool project for him to go back and play with his old buddies.
Yeah, could you imagine after, so you were left behind. This is when he was in Florida, and they just couldn't get critical mass. And like one of the local guys went and joined the Eagles, and some of these guys in the area were making it big. This is in Gainesville, Florida. And Tom Petty and his group, they just couldn't make the jump. So he quit that band, took a couple of those guys with him, and then they went out to L.A., and that's where they formed the Heartbreakers, and then they made it huge, gigantic band, you know, massive fame. And could you imagine if you were like the drummer or the, you know, one of the guys in Mudcrutch who didn't make it, and Tom Petty calls you up and said, hey, we want to go in the studio and make an album? I think you'd say yes.
Yeah. Let me check my schedule.
Yeah. I'm free for the next 10 years. So say when.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I like stuff like that. Let's go to Jordan now in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Jordan.
So my question is about the virtue of patriotism. I don't quite understand how it fits in with a lot of the other virtues. I don't really have a good understanding of how it's spiritually beneficial, and I've always struggled with patriotism. I'm not very patriotic, which obviously is a little bit more difficult in these times, but I'm just wondering what you have to say about patriotism.
Sure. When you say patriotism, I assume I know what you mean, but could you define it just to make sure that you and I are talking about the same thing?
Well, I don't really have a good definition of patriotism. I suppose that's one of the things that you could help with.
Okay.
But yeah.
Sure. Okay. So when I think of the word patriotism, I think of love for your country and a desire to see your country flourish, and also a certain kind of pride, not in the sinful sense, but a certain kind of pride in your country and its achievements and its history. Now, obviously, any country is going to be a mixed bag. Let's take the United States of America. Obviously, it's a mixed bag. We have slavery, but we also have many contributions that have helped mankind in fantastic ways. The American experience is filled with bright spots and black spots, dark spots, you know, evil chapters in the history of the country. But much of it was very, very good. So when I think of patriotism, or on the 4th of July, when I'm reflecting upon the freedom that we have, for me, patriotism is a love for my country and a desire to see the country be as good as it can, and gratitude for the good things that have come to me by virtue of being an American, and pride in that sense of the good things that have been done in this country. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that I don't recognize the bad things, but I'm grateful for the good things. So when I say the word patriotism, that's what I think of, first of all. Okay. So that would be, if we're looking at this from a theological perspective, that would be merely a natural virtue. It's not a supernatural virtue. It's not a virtue that will affect your salvation. You can be unpatriotic in the sense that you don't care, and it's not really your thing. You don't really think much about American history, or you don't really think much about where the country is going. And I suppose there are people like that. But that wouldn't affect your salvation one way or the other. It would really only tie into supernatural virtue insofar as it would be a manifestation of your charity toward other people. So charity, of course, is a supernatural virtue. And if one expression of your charity toward others includes your love for your country and your love for your fellow Americans and your desire for their health and well-being, that's a form of charity. But it is, patriotism itself is merely a natural virtue, but it can be an extension of a supernatural virtue in that context. What do you think?
Okay, so that helps me quite a bit. So basically, one of my qualms is, but that you've helped me with, is that I'm not like obligated to be proud in the good sense of my country for some of the not so good things that it's done. That helps me a lot in understanding it.
Oh, good. I'm glad. And you know, in a way, I really do believe that by being aware of and being sorrowful over those terrible things that were done in any given country, that is a form of patriotism. Because in other words, then you love your country enough to want to see it get better. You love your country enough to recognize its faults and failings and desire that it avoid those in the future. That, I think, is part of being truly patriotic, honestly.
Well, thank you.
You're most welcome. Yeah.
Happy Taco Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. How could I forget that? Well, thank you, Jordan. I appreciate that. Good to talk to you. 888-914-9149. How did that get by me, Cyrus? That's a first.
You were excited about all these new bumpers I had.
Yes. Maybe you can play another one or play one over again. I really like these.
Yeah, these are great.
I like that one by Duran Duran.
That they're more punk than I ever would have. When you sent me that to turn into a song or
that's
into a rejoin,
it's
pretty.
No,
it's thumping. It's not all right.
No,
all right,
no,
I stand
no,
corrected.
No,
I'm not gonna.
No,
I'm not gonna die
no.
on
listen
that hill.
Listen to X or Black Flag or the Dead Kennedys. I mean, that's punk.
Okay.
And I won't say the name of the main punk band because it's a crude name, but that's punk. Duran Duran, but interesting thing, Cyrus. Duran Duran, those five guys, well, four of them were from Birmingham, and one of them, Simon Le Bon, came from elsewhere. I forget where he was. It might have been London. John Taylor, the bass player for Duran Duran, he was raised Catholic. And he lived his childhood and adolescence as a Catholic. He was sent to a Catholic school. He received his sacraments. And when he got to high school, he sort of dropped out of all that. I just finished his autobiography. And it is quite interesting. And I was interested in him musically, but I was particularly interested as I started reading the book because I didn't know his background at all. I was interested in what for him was it like to be a Catholic, to be raised Catholic, and then to get sucked into that vortex of fame and stardom and money and girls and drugs and all the other stuff. And I mean, they were the number one band for probably 5 years running in terms of album sales and how much money they made. And it's a fascinating story, but this guy lost his faith almost immediately. And it really began in high school. But it started in earnest by the time he was, you know, with Duran Duran. He formed the band with a couple of other guys. And by that point, he was, yeah, there you go. That Duran Duran. And by the way, Cyrus, this is not punk.
This is what I think of with Duran Duran. That other song, you said he didn't sound like them at all.
Well, check it out. That other song came out on an album after this album. So anyway, let's get back to it. Okay. Now this is good though. I mean, So he's a Catholic guy, and he was an only child. His mom and dad raised him Catholic. They were Catholic, and he actually talks about this in this autobiography, and where it really began to kind of get to him. He never came back to the Catholic Church, by the way. He's my age, and as far as I'm concerned, as far as I'm aware, based upon what he wrote, he has not had a return to his Catholic faith. I hope and pray that he does before it's too late. But in the part of the book where he's talking about the girls, and I'm going to be discreet about this, if you can imagine that lifestyle and going from one city to the next and all the girls, so he talks candidly about this. But he says he got to the point where he realized, okay, there's something wrong here. There's all of these anonymous encounters every night, every other night, every different city, every place, over and over and over again for years. He got to the point where he's in the book, he's saying, I realized there's something wrong with this. And, you know, I was raised Catholic, and didn't my mother teach me, you know, not to do such things? And it was interesting for me to see him kind of reflecting upon that and thinking about it. The only problem is that he didn't take the right step and have a repentance. He actually sort of got a kind of self-help type religion. And that helped him get clean and sober because he was using drugs and he was drinking like a fish. But the result of that was he sort of opted in favor of, and I wish I had the book here in the studio, I would share with you a particular sentence that he wrote, but I'll summarize it. He said that he realized when he was in this detox program for like 30 days, he was in Tucson and he was just trying to detox. And it wasn't just the drugs and it wasn't just the alcohol. It was also all the women. You know, he was addicted to that. And with all the years of it, he realized that he had to sort of change his ways. So anyway, he talks about how in this therapy, what he learned, quote unquote, was that he's not responsible for any of it, that he has a genetic inclination to alcoholism. And I don't doubt that part of it, and that may well be true of many people who don't know how to process it, therefore it gets the better of them and they become alcoholics. And I know the CDC says we can't say that, but I don't follow those CDC guidelines. But he took a wrong turn there, because what I realized as he said this was, he came to the point where he realized that all of this excess, all of the girls and all of the drugs and all of the everything else, he said, it wasn't my fault. I was liberated and I was happy, and I realized that I could overcome these things because I was just, you know, prone to this because of the genetic predisposition that I have. And I thought, oh, come on. Wrong answer. That may be true perhaps for the drugs or perhaps for the alcohol, but not the other stuff. And so what saddened me as I read this very interesting book was how he got right up to the edge of figuring it out and realizing, I need to turn my life around. I need to get God back in my life. And he got right up to the edge and he didn't go over it. He went in another direction. And so now I guess the self-help and those other things are what he looks to, but it made me fearful for him, because if you're not repentant of your sins, you can't be forgiven for your sins. So another reminder, I guess, about how fame and fortune will really do a number on you. And it really does a number on a lot of people, maybe not everybody, but it certainly does a number on a lot of people. And some people, they never recover from it. And I said a little prayer for John Taylor. He actually strikes me as a very likable guy. I would have loved to have known him. I doubt I'll ever get that chance, but I found him to be very engaging and very thoughtful. And this was a surprisingly well-written book. You'd figure a lot of people in that world probably don't know how to string two words together coherently, but it was very interesting. And that perhaps for me was the most interesting part of the whole thing. Was his Catholic faith kind of at the bottom of all of this and what happened to it? And Jesus said, you know, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. He's not saying it's impossible, certainly not impossible, but it's very difficult if you are so entangled with all these other things that there's no room for God. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Rosie in California. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure,
so
you're welcome.
I'm calling in for advice. Last week, I was talking to my mother-in-law, and so long story short, my husband was attending. He was a non-denominational Christian before we met.
Uh-huh.
He did RCIA. And he converted to Catholicism, but he's had a hard time with that. I feel like he only did it to marry me, you know, not really because he wanted to. Anyway.
Rosie, do me a favor. Hold your mouth right up to the phone because you're sort of fading in and
out.
I'm sorry. Yeah, stay right on the phone. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, we've been having hard times. He's having hard times. And my mother-in-law suggested that, you know, he go back to another church, maybe that would help him. And all I said was no, but I didn't really know how to answer her, you know, like why I'm not okay with him doing that.
So his mother or your mother suggested it?
No, his mother.
Okay. And she, I take it, is not a Catholic, right?
No, I believe when she was little she was, but as a grown-up, no. Non-denominational Christian.
Okay, so here would be my advice. First of all, your instinct is correct. You don't want to go backward, you want to go forward. So it would be counterproductive for him to leave the Catholic Church and go in a different direction. Now, the question remains, however, his commitment to the Catholic faith. And does he really have that heartfelt experience of Jesus? Does he really know why he's a Catholic? And I understand sometimes people do make this decision to become a Catholic in order to please a spouse or a family. And, you know, these things happen, but ideally somebody who becomes Catholic does it not for those reasons, but because they've become convinced that it's true and this is the fullness of the faith. So it sounds as though he hasn't ever gotten to that point. So my advice would be, if he's willing, ply him with resources that can help him see that. Maybe share with him Father Mike Schmidt's videos. He's very effective at explaining the faith. And the videos are typically short, you know, 5 to 6 minutes long. I would I would encourage him to watch some of those, and you can look him up on YouTube and then pick out different topics that you think might be helpful for him. I'm a big fan of Father Bill Casey. If you want to write these resource names down, I think they'll be helpful to you. Father Bill Casey is one of the Fathers of Mercy, a powerful preacher, and his message is very galvanizing. And if you look for him on YouTube, for example, one of his talks that's really powerful is called Lukewarm Catholicism, and you can get that on YouTube. And play that for your husband. Maybe listen to it with him. Say, you know, let's pour a glass of wine and sit down after the kids are in bed, and let's listen to this talk together. I would very much recommend the Thomistic Institute. They have a series on YouTube called Aquinas 101, and they get into all just about anything you could think of as far as the Christian life is concerned, and they look at it through a very accessible, very easy to understand Thomistic lens. These are all free. These are all things you could do. I mean, I would start there, Rosie, and just keep it up. Keep praying for him. Keep giving him some of these good resources. And maybe if you can, get him to listen to the Patrick Madrid Show. I'll help you help him. Thanks, Rosie. I'll be right back.